justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Tony Medina. Tony Medina is a poet and editor of more than 20 books for adults and young readers. Tony Medina is a professor at Howard University, where he teaches creative writing. How are you doing today, Tony?
How you doing, Ethelbert? Great to be here.
Okay. You know, I want to ask you, you came to Howard University in 2003. What made you leave? You know, you were teaching up in New York. What made you relocate to this area?
Well, I didn't plan on that. I was an adjunct professor at the Brooklyn campus of Long Island University, downtown Brooklyn. I was doing that for like 8 years, teaching remedial English, comp courses. Then an opportunity came where I can go study, get my graduate degree at Binghamton University, which I got a master's and a PhD, studied with the great Maria Gillen, Maria Mazzotti Gillen. And off of that, in the middle of that program, first I had to do the master's and get that out the way and graduate from that and then reapply for the PhD, all that stuff. I happened to be in Chicago. Penn sent me out there with my children's books. And I got a phone call from Koresh Ali Lansana and Patrick Oliver. They were at Chicago Press working over there. I mean, Third World Press in Chicago. And they said, you need to come to the press and, you know, see us today. I said, okay, I got a day off. I'm going to go out there. As soon as I got there, they said that Eleanor Traylor was upstairs, Dr. Eleanor Traylor, talking with Hakeem Madhubuti, and that he happened to mention that I was, you know, getting a PhD. And she jumped up and down and said, I want Medina at Howard. I want Medina at Howard. And so that's how it began. And she said that she was going to give me a formal invitation. But first I did the Hard Today program, and then she sent
me. You sound like you were a first-round draft pick.
Yeah, like that. I mean, I didn't have to go on the market, as they say.
Right.
So as I graduated, I had a job waiting for me at Howard. And they brought me in as a visiting artist. You know, I think Haki did that at one time, and then Sonia Sanchez did that at one time. And then I was like the third one, I'm not sure. And then they opened up a year later, they opened up a position for me. And that's how it started.
Let's move beyond the position, because one of the things I was dealing with a number of years ago was developing creative writing programs at historic Black colleges, because there weren't any. You're teaching creative writing at Howard, right?
Very popular, yes.
Right. And that's what I'm aware of that. But there's not a program. If I wanted to get a degree in creative writing, is that just on undergraduate? I mean, there's no MFA program there yet.
Well, right. Well, what I did was, when I was on these curriculum committees and stuff, I kept, you know, hammering away about the idea. My colleagues were like all for it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, like Howard is very bureaucratic, like any other institution. So it took a long time. But so we started, I guess, small, which was to create a concentration under the English major, kind of like a minor.
Right.
So students can concentrate in creative writing. With the idea, and I put the idea like over 10 years ago in their minds that, look, we could create a low-res MFA program here. We could be the first Black university to do this thing.
And they were sort of like a Bennington, a low-residency program.
Like that.
Right.
Because I thought that that would be easier and more financially, you know, doable.
Mm-hmm.
Because we could just use writers from all over the country and they don't have to be on campus and all that stuff. So that was my idea. And so we've been working towards that model.
Now you have a number of colleagues there. You got Patrice Elam, you got AJ Verdell. So it seems that you've got the people in place to have a program.
Yeah, we do, because we were able to, well, Patricia was there before. Eleanor Traylor got her to teach, you know, in the writing program. Then she had to leave because she had family emergencies. And then we got a line for creative writing. And so she came back and got that line. So since I was the only creative writing, now she was the second one. 2 years ago, we interviewed for Creative Writing Line for nonfiction, because I was poetry, Patricia was fiction. And so the two candidates that we had, we could only pick one, but I kind of fought for us to get a to have both of them. And so now we have two. And, you know, they're kind of like in sports. They're two-way players, you know.
Right. So let me ask you this. When if I'm looking at a program, I'm looking, I want to be a writer, and I come to Howard University. What are you just teaching poetry? And when you first were hired, were you teaching a number of different things? Because, I mean, you're multi-talented.
I remember the legend has it that you have been like the de facto creative writing person that anybody who wanted to be a writer or a poet would go up to your tower over there at.
Yeah, but I had no program. I couldn't hand out any degrees.
You were like mentoring all these people informally before I even got there. But I guess, you know, for some reason I've been treating the creative writing that I teach, the classes I teach, because you have to teach other classes besides creative writing. I got to the point where I can just teach creative writing now, thank God.
Right.
But I was teaching it on the undergraduate level, but my classes were so intense in a sense that, you know, produce. And I was teaching them everything I knew about writing and publishing and all that stuff, that it was almost like a graduate program on the undergraduate level, mm-hmm. whereby a lot of my students have gone on to have careers in the literary world.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. Let me slow you down. And so I signed up for your class. Mm-hmm. What do you want me to learn? You know, if it's a semester, what do you want me to learn a semester? Also, what are you teaching? Are you using any particular books or things of that sort? But, you know, just what's on the curriculum? What am I going to learn?
In the beginning, when I first got here, I would be using books in my intro class, I'll be using books by poets. So let's say if you came out with a book of poetry, I wanted them to know who you were, study your work, and even put reviews on Amazon and stuff for your work and stuff like that, to not only inform them, but also to give the poet play that normally would not get any exposure like that in these classes. I may use a craft course, but I would mainly teach them throughout the semester different various forms, mainly forms written by, you know, created by folks of color and stuff like that. Mm. But, you know, the usual standard things like sonnets and stuff like that as well.
You know what I admired about you, Tony? I remember, this is a number of years ago, but you would bring your students to like Bus Boys and Poets. You know, you were not just teaching in the classroom. You were making sure that, okay, just don't go there. I'm going to come with you.
Well, I remember when they had, what was the bookstore they had on?
Teaching for Change.
No, before that, the sister one.
Sister Space?
Yeah. I remember early on, I said I ordered my books at Sister Space so that to give that business play. This is prior to them getting pushed up due to gentrification. And then Nikki Finney was supposed to was in town to do a reading. So her book was on my syllabus. So I brought all my students there. And I think Fred Joyner was came to that. And he asked if he could come to my class. I said, sure, it's open to the public, basically. And that's how all the D.C. people started coming to my class and crashing it.
Right. Okay. Well, before we crash, you're up in New York. I want you to flesh out, because I find when we look up, there's not a lot of information about your growing up. And so I want you to take us into the Medina household, you know, because you wound up being in the South Bronx after I had left the South Bronx.
Yeah, it was wild. I was born in the South Bronx. Wow. The hospital I was born in, I don't think it exists in a Morrisania hospital.
Okay, I was Lincoln, I think, of one of those hospitals down there that should have closed early.
You know, I was literally abandoned in the hospital by my mom because, well, not abandoned in a sense, but she was high on heroin. And she was afraid that and I was very sick when I came out the womb. You know, they had to put me in the incubator. And so when, and I found out this as an adult many, many years later. And so when the doctors couldn't figure out what's wrong with me. They kept pleading with her. Like, so she told me her last year of life when I took care of her that she had to confess and tell them, you know, that she was on drugs or whatever. So I became a ward of the state my first year, and I was raised by a white family, probably Jewish, in Queens, New York. My paternal grandmother, the last of the big mamas, Gussie, Augusta, she fought to get custody of me, and she convinced my mom that she would be, I would be better off raised with her. So I lived on Simpson Street my first
year. Simpson Street, that's down there like by Prospect. Right. That's Marsania.
And then, you know, like the Jeffersons moving on up.
Right.
Moving on up was going from the tenements in the South Bronx to the projects.
Right.
So we moved. I guess I was about six or seven or whatever. We moved to the projects of Throgs Neck. Mm-hmm. Famous Dewey Avenue, where Grandmaster Flash is from. And I was there for most of my life, and then we moved to Co-op City. Half of us stayed in Throgs Neck, half went to Co-op City, and then I went to the military.
Oh, I remember when Co-op City was being built. That Co-op City, that was really moving up.
And it was in the ninth grade. I went to junior high school 101 on Bruckner Boulevard.
Now, you know, when somebody hears you, Tony Medina, somebody immediately thinks, okay, Tony must be Puerto Rican. You know,
yes, I am.
So talk about that, because, you know, there are places in your early poems that, you know, the Spanish comes in there. And so when I think of Tony Medina, I think of the New Ricans, you know, yeah. And that whole network of folks who are extremely talented. So how did you identify with that? Because I know that if you was Puerto Rican, there were certain writers that you just say, okay, I've got to read my Perry Thomas. I've got to read, you know.
Oh, yeah, that was an early influence. I had a friend in the projects. Well, I didn't grow up with books, so I didn't really have this love for reading and the discipline. You know, I was TV, movies, you know, I was into all that. And my attention span was like, you know, really short. So I had this friend named Troy Ward, and he would steal books from the library. He would push them on me. You got to read this, Tony. You got to read this. So he started pushing books like Man, Child, and the Promised Land.
Wait a minute, Tony, I got to stop you. So you didn't want to get a library card? You got somebody
stealing. That came later.
That came later, okay.
So he was the first one to kind of influence me to read. And, you know, those were the books that I read first. But I really didn't catch on to the reading part until I was in the ninth grade and I had to do this book report. And I didn't do the first one because I was lazy. So I was given a second opportunity, and I didn't want to, upset my grandmother. You know how you are when you're a kid. I looked up to her, and so I did it. And I took out this book named Flowers for Algernon. And that's the book that changed my life. Before that, as you know, I was a young kid, and baseball was my passion. Right. I was a fanatic. I slept with my baseball gloves. And remember classic Yankee World Series and stuff like that in the 70s. But I knew, being so little and skinny, there was no way.
you could have been a little Phil Rizzuto type of guy or something.
There's no way I was going to be a baseball player.
Right.
But I was good.
Right. You know?
I wasn't great. I was good in my neighborhood. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, where did poetry come into your life?
Oh, so once I started reading, mm-hmm. that I read that one book, and I was like, oh my God, I want to be a writer. So I went through the whole list that the teacher gave us, Mr. De Los Reyes, and I started reading over that summer all those books on that list. And those books led to these other books. So by the time I reached, like, let's say the 12th grade, I had 3 years of intense reading. Somehow or another, I was ironing my clothes for school the next day, watching The Honeymooners or The Odd Couple or whatever, and a poem came into my head. I wrote it down on some downy paper. Another poem came, I wrote down. I entered a poetry contest. I won the poetry contest. By that time, I was reading, you know, like Writer's Digest magazine, Poets Market, that type of stuff. And I knew how to submit my work professionally. My aunt bought me a little manual typewriter. I already was identifying as a writer. So once I won that contest and I wrote those first initial poems, that's when I started reading poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Dylan Thomas, Emily Dickinson, you know.
You know, when I look at, if I was studying your work, and this was an assignment, to me, when I come to Tony Medina, you're New York. I mean, you take us into the streets of New York, and I wanted you to read, Alibi, it's in your book, Sermon from the Smell of a Carcass, Condemned to Begging.
Yeah, that is a long title. Well, you know, this is a poem in the voice of a homeless everyman, a persona type of poem that came to me. I guess I was reading a lot of Nicanor Parra, the Chilean poet, who came up with the notion of anti-poetry. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of like the opposite of Pablo Neruda,
right.
Less adorned language and stuff like that, and more plain-spoken, satirical. And always ribbing, you know, ribbing.
This is where the long title comes from.
Capitalism. The long title comes from me.
Okay.
But this is one of the sermons from Broke. It's called Alibis. And Broke is a homeless everyman. They'll tell you I wasn't there when he perished. I was across the street looking in shop windows. I didn't see him laid out on the pavement. I was on my way to the theater. I was reading my paper, the Wall Street Journal, tracing my investments. I was rushing through Grand Central Station like a madman, trying to catch a train out the city on my way home from work.
Listening to Tony Medina reading from his book, Sermons from the Smell of a Carcass Condemned to Begging. You know, when I look at your poetry and in this book and other collection, there is a theme that jumps out. And we can even look at this poem carefully that you just read. You address the issue of poverty. You address issues of class. Okay. There's also in this poem, Alibi, that you just read, it sounds a little Frank O'Hara, you know, like, you know, I was to Grand Jason Station and it was, you know, waiting for the 8:45 or something like that, you know. So, and that's why I'm saying about, you know, your work captures a city. And I'm thinking of how some writers are associated with a city, you know, Bukowski, Wanda Cohen with LA. And when I think of New York, I think of you.
Yeah. I mean, when I was a kid living in the projects, my father would come around every so often. I wasn't raised by him, of course. And early on, I was affected by Al Pacino and Justice, Dog Day Afternoon. My uncle took me to, and he passed last year, my uncle Fred, he took me to see Dog Day Afternoon in the theater. I think it was on, you know, East Tremont Avenue, that theater that was there. And I was so mesmerized by Pacino's performance. I wanted to be an actor. And so, you know, and I was always putting on shows and acting out and being comedic and stuff. So my father took me to acting school down in Times Square area when I was a kid on Saturdays. And that was the first time I encountered the homeless. Hmm. I mean, even living in the projects, I didn't see any homeless people and stuff. And so I've always been haunted by, you know, I said, well, who are these people sleeping on the train? And he would tell me. And then, you know, in the dead of winter, and I was just like, so I've been so obsessed, I guess, and Broke comes out of that. And yeah, I don't know. It's hard to take the New York out of you. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, you know, we wouldn't want to do that. But what I find interesting, and this gets into the symbolism, you were born the year that people established Black Power. Okay. And when I think of Tony Medina, I said, you know, Tony Medina is like definitely part of like the Black Arts Movement. But I want to hold off on that, you know, and the Tony Sanchez and Hakeem, people like that, because I want to ask you, Tony Medina, the impact of the Black Lives Matter, you know, movement on you, you know, Black Lives Matter movement.
I think I was doing Black Lives Matter poetry before.
Right. But I'm glad you say that because, you know, the other theme that shows up and you have a graphic novel dealing with this, you know, you are not just dealing with poverty and things like that. You're dealing with police brutality.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is seems to be something that makes it, you know, well, that definitely linked to the Black Lives Matter movement because that's how it begins in terms of these deaths. How do you, coming through the streets of New York, you know, where there have been a number of cases, do you feel safe as an African-American male?
No. And, you know, when I was, when all these incidents started happening in the last 10, 15 years, And we were writing about it. We were posting it on social media. And I began writing the graphic novel, I Am Alfonso Jones. I was really scared to get in my car and go to the store to go get gas and stuff. Mm-hmm. And one time, this sister, she was a police officer, she pulled me over. And I was like, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. And right on East-West Highway, which is not too far from here. It's like a couple of minutes. And I was just so nervous. And she knew that I was nervous, so she kind of calmed me down. She calmed me down, and I said, can I ask you a question? She says, yeah. I said, why when you pull me over, there's like about two or three other police cars and stuff? Oh, she said, oh, that's because, you know, we want to make sure everything goes well. And I said, yeah, because that's very intimidating.
Yeah, that's what they want to do.
It makes you very nervous. And now, even with this situation with the immigration and ICE and Trump, and Stephen Miller and these nutty people, I started traveling with my passport because I could get deported just for GP. You know, they're right. Just doing it, you know, just to mess with you, like they did with Ross Baraka in Newark and stuff, like, you know, this type of stuff. So you get very nervous at times in our country now because we're very kind of insecure and vulnerable. It's totally different than, you know.
But when I look at your poems that you've dealt with, I find they're in two groups. There are poems about black men who have been killed by police men, and then there are black people who died in police custody.
Yeah.
You know, talk about that, because those are two different things, and you document in your work.
Really, like, heart-wrenching. I remember when Freddie Gray was killed. All day I was posting, I was so angry, so pissed off. I went to sleep that evening. I woke up with this poem that came out of me.
Why don't you read that poem from the Crushed Voice Box of Freddie Gray? And that's in your anthology, Resisting Arrest.
Okay. So just to preface it, there was another incident that happened where a young brother was handcuffed in the back of a police car, and he ended up being shot at point blank range in the chest in the back of the police car. And the medical examiner ruled it a suicide. So this was in my mind when I wrote this poem. It's called From the Crushed Voice Box of Freddie Gray. I am the magic Negro, the black Houdini who done it to himself. I handcuffed my own damn self. I threw myself in the back of the patrol car, my hands shackled behind my back, slave ship cargo ago. I am the magic Negro, the black Houdini who does it to himself, him black self. See, ma, no hands. I snatched the pistol from the white man's mind, from the back of the patrol car. Suck on this, Houdini. I grabbed the gun and shoot myself in the chest, neo-colonial style. The autopsy report says, damn, would have been easier to walk on water. I bet you a quarter he done shot himself. I am the magic Negro. Spineless, I broke my own spine after hog tying myself into a pretzel. Even Houdini, who done it, would envy, only to turn myself into a human pinball rattling around a steel gullet of a Negro pickup truck, once reserved for newly arrived potato famine New York Irish drunks down on their luck. Me, moi, it is I who was Othello. Oh, hell no, yes, me. The magic Negro, the black Houdini, who done it, does it all the time to himself, his own damned self.
You're listening to Tony Medina reading his poem from the Crushed Voice Box of Freddie Gray, a poem that's included in his anthology, Resisting Arrest. Tony, do me a favor and read the other poem that you have in this anthology. It has a hashtag.
It's called hashtag If I Die in Police Custody, which kind of is an offshoot of this other poem, the Freddie Gray poem. If I die in police custody, Know that I am not Houdini. That hole in my chest did not magically appear, regardless of my hands cuffed behind my back. That I preferred my blood inside my body instead of pouring through powder-burnt flesh, pooling at my feet in the back seat of some patrol car. If I die in police custody, don't let my bone fragments puzzle the public when the police insist I reached for a gun. That if I had magic powers, I would not use them to end my little life, but to save it.
Tony Medina reading his poem, If I Die in Police Custody. You know, one of the things I like how you used your Houdini, because many times, you know, we look at Houdini as this magic, but Houdini was like an escape artist more than a magician. But talk about how you also are dealing with an image that we see in the movie, The Magical Negro.
Well, yeah, it seems like in this country, maybe in other countries too, I guess South Africa, whatever, they think that Black folks don't experience pain. You know, the medical profession treats Black women like, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. And that, you know, remember when Obama was running for office, they wanted him to be everything. He became the magic Negro. And so that was rumbling around in my mind, in my subconscious, when I wrote this particular piece, where, you know, the absurdity of racism itself, but also police brutality, and how the victim is always the one who's being brutalized or killed, is always it's always magically their fault. You know?
Yeah. You know, we're going to take a little break, Tony Medina, and then we'll come back. And I want to ask you some questions about the anthology that you've been reading from, Resisting Arrest, because sadly, there are a number of people who contributed to this book who are no longer living, Venus Thrash, Jerry Ward, Reuben Jackson. And so I think of, you know, how these books not only documented the issue of police brutality, but also preserved the memory of some of these writers who addressed that issue.
Okay, great.
Okay. So my guest today is Tony Medina. He's a professor of creative writing at Howard University. He's the author of more than 20 books for adults and young readers. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of July 7th, 2025. On Thursday, July 10th, from 6:30 to 10:30 p.m., Sankofa Video Books and Cafe presents Togetherness, poetry reading and discussion with poet Savannah Sweetwater Morgan, located at 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. To RSVP, go to Sankofa.com. Friday, July 11th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Sankofa Video and Books presents Lakita Wilson, Pretty Girl County, book event located at 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info and to RSVP, go to Sankofa.com. Finally, Sunday, July 13th, starting at 7 p.m., join Haile Garima and Sankofa Video and Books at Congo on Our Mind, featuring Ayana Gregory. All DMV artists are welcome and encouraged to participate. All proceeds will aid in supporting this station, WPFW 89.3, and 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. is the address. For more info and to RSVP, visit www.sankofa.com. WPFW's social justice calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's social justice calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Tony Medina. Tony, talk about Resisting Arrest, this anthology that you did a number of years ago. How did you get the word out? Were there many poems that you rejected for any particular reason? And then also the whole thing in terms of putting an anthology together and having the poems speak to each other.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite anthologies because it's so tight from the first poem. I think Martina Espada opens it to the last poem. Which I think it's Joy Harjo, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do something about police brutality. I had this idea for Resisting Arrest a long time ago before I came out to D.C. And I approached Sam Anderson, who did In Defense of Mumia with me. I don't think he liked the title, Resisting Arrest, but I liked it and I kept it. I approached Richard Krywek from Jacquard Press if he thought, you know, he'd be interested in something like that. And he jumped on it, you know. And so this was an anthology where, you know, unlike doing an anthology with someone else, and you've done a couple that you were just the sole editor, it was kind of easier and smoother, you know, and the press was able to do a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of contacting people and doing all the administrative work.
That's a lot of work.
Then normally I would have to do with a partner, like, say, on In Defense of Mumia or Bum Rush the Page and Roll Call. These are mammoth collections. So this one was a bit more smoothly, and it was very focused and tight. And I kind of, like, just picked the people that I saw doing stuff around police brutality. And a friend of mine, Meta Sama, a poet, she kind of helped and reached out and got some people. And I wrote the introduction, and she edited it really well. So the tight introduction that I have in here is due to her. And you mentioned that a few people passed, and I'm always shaken when someone in our community passes away, particularly younger, writer and stuff like that.
You know, and then I would add, there's two writers that who always address police violence and brutality. One was Sterling Brown. And in the second book, the Wild Bill, that's right, Wild Bill, that, you know, somebody said, how come we didn't hear anything after Southern Road? Well, you read those poems back then. And then the other person is June Jordan, you know, was very outspoken about, you know, police violence. And I think
of my head, Ethelbert, when I was writing, I think reading that Freddie Gray poem, she was kind of in my head in some of those lines. It resonated. Something of hers when she talked about in Living Room, when she talked about that poem she had, right?
So talk about, you know, this comes into an interesting thing in terms of the writer's voice. We talked about your work being very New York and urban. What happens when the writer moves from, say, the street to the campus? I go back and I look at, for example, you could take Haki, you could take Sonia. There were a number of people who were very active, and as soon as they, say, got tenure, they all of a sudden they had villanelles, you know, or something, you know, where before it was free verse and it was like, you know, die, you know, where's the revolution?
Okay.
But, you know, and I just say that in terms of, a voice changes, you know, you're growing older, you know, you have a tendency, okay, I'm now a teacher, people are looking up to me, you know, I'm part of a tradition. So I'm just wondering how you have changed over the last few years.
Well, you know, when I was a neophyte in my 20s, it was like, you know, like the Beats, first thought, best thought.
Right.
The hell with form. Only to find out that anything you do is form, basically. So you go from free verse to, oh, I want to rock a haiku, like, and Ethridge Knight and blah, blah, blah. So you start doing forms and you start kind of liking them. And when you do your first sonnet, it's like, oh, my God, this sounds really great. I don't even know how I did this or how line one went all the way down to 14, how I got there. So then you start teaching forms and you see how they're very helpful. Like, even when I'm so-called not writing a poem or wanting to write a poem, I can just, my go-to would be like, well, let me try to write a haiku. I'm in the airport. Let me do a haiku. And that leads to something because it's so structured, so disciplined. And
well, let's look at something that you probably see your colleagues doing. And I think it's an outgrowth of creative writing program. Because we have such a Black presence now in creative writing program, we have a number of African-American writers who have come up with their forms, whether it's Afar Michael Weaver, Terrence Haynes, Truth Thomas. They've come up with their own, Maritza Rivera. They come up with their own forms. Are these forms that become part of tradition? Because I remember I was doing an interview with Ed Hirsch, and I said, okay, are some of these forms going to make it that these African-American writers are creating? Are they going to make it into your book on poetics?
Well, you know, I created a form, too, called the Totem.
No, I didn't want to talk about you.
It's a form of forms.
Right.
But they become part of when everybody starts writing them, like the Kwan Saba.
Right. That was Eugene Redman.
Eugene Redman, Terrence Hayes have the form. Mm-hmm. Haven't written that form yet, but it was inspired by, I think,
Gwendolyn Brooks, the shovel, golden shovel.
And Haki, I mean, Sonya had the Sonku, Omiri had the Loku. So you start doing that, and then mm-hmm. I even encourage students kind of to do their own forms. Truth Thomas came up with the skinny.
Right.
The journal. So he's kind of institutionalizing his form. Afa Weaver in
Terrence. That was the bop or something a long time ago.
That was a bop anthology that they've been trying to do for like almost 20 years. And now it's finally coming out. Mm. So that's how it builds by other people doing it, by people teaching it, and then by those poems getting published and exposure. Mm.
Well, let's talk about publishing and shift to something which you've become very much associated with, and that's children's literature. You know, and I saw that one of your books, like the Bob Marley book, was done by Lee and Lowe, you know, and I remember when that company was started, which was beautiful because they definitely had a focus on, you know, multicultural literature, and they did really, really nice books. Talk about what led you into children's writing, because when I look at children's writing along with maybe Steptoe, but many of the women, many of the children writers were women writers who said, okay, I go into a store, you know, I'm a mother, I don't see the books for my children, so I will write the books.
Yeah.
You know, so what motivated you to write for children?
You know, there was a whole movement, a black arts movement, Tom Feelings and all those kids, mm-hmm. the Hudsons. But what motivated me, you know, one of my heroes, which I'm sure you share the same, is Langston Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was always admiring how Langston wrote for adults and young people. And I didn't grow up with children's books. The only children's books we got to see were, you know, at school, at the library, when we had library class or whatever. And it was Curious George or whatever, you know.
Which I always thought was interesting.
I kind of fell in love with children's books as an adult and was fascinated by the form, the marriage between text and art, and how these beautiful books are like little art galleries and stuff like that. So an opportunity came. I think Kalamo had this listserv before social media and all this stuff back in the 90s where he shared all this information. It was like a community listserv, kind of like Facebook, but
yeah, he was the first person I saw, and I think we were in Salt Lake City. He's the first person who read his speech from his computer, you know, you know, like Edison with a light bulb.
I guess he stole your first initial E, and he called it E-drum.
No,
I think we're all connected on that, all the writers of color and stuff.
Well, he gave me the nickname Issue, which was another issue.
It's Tandaria.
Right, exactly.
So there was an editor for Lee and Lowe at the time, Laura Atkins. She was looking for work. You know, she was, you know, one of those fearless visionary editors that goes out and looking for writers and stuff, trying to be more diverse. And so she just wrote a little blurb about what she's looking for and stuff like that. And I've been trying to write about kids from the projects instead of like middle class and upper. And so I started writing these poems. I said I got inspired by that request, and I sent her some poems, and they were in the voice of this kid named Deshaun Williams, and I took the name from my cousin Deshaun, and that's how it got started for me. She really liked what she heard. She met with me downtown. We talked, and then she said, "Well, write me some more stuff." So I wrote some more towards that. And that became the basis of my first book, Deshaun Days.
Mm.
But I love Lee and Lowe Press is really great. I mean, Lee and Lowe books are really great. I love working with them. I love children's books. I love middle grade books. I love all that stuff.
Yeah, talk about how you move from the books for children into the graphic novel now. And then you did I Am Alfonso Jones, which ties in with police brutality, what we were just talking about.
Yeah, it just so happened that I was kind of inspired. I really was like really digging that form, the graphic novel. And I remember a book, Yummy, was out by Gene Nery and stuff. And I was like, Lee and Lowe put that out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their first one. And they had a lot of, you know, when it's your first one, it's like, how do we do this thing?
Right.
It's so difficult. And I didn't even know how you do comics. I don't know how they put the words in the bubbles and all that stuff. So I've been wanting to do something like that. And it just so happened that Lean Low kind of wanted to do something about police brutality because it was so big. And so it was just...
So how did you get to work with Stacey Robinson and John Jennings? How did that chemistry work?
Initially, I said, I want a woman of color to be my illustrator, to have the balance, gender, and stuff like that. And so initially, it was an Asian sister who was the illustrator. But for some reason, she said, oh, this is too personal, which I took to being, it was too politically hot or whatever. So she sat on it for like almost a year or so, or 6 months, I think. She sat on the book without doing anything. So then Stacy Whitman, our editor slash publisher for two books, which is an imprint of Lean Low, she really liked John Jennings's work. And she asked me if I knew who John Jennings was. I said, I never met him, but I know of him. And, you know, we have mutual people in common and stuff. So she approached him. And he was busy doing Kindred, I think. Hmm. And so he asked one of his students, Stacy Robinson, to take the lead and do the lead art. And he'll do the coloring and stuff like that. And they were just, they read the manuscript and was like, yeah, we want to do this. Because it was in their wheelhouse, in their politics and stuff.
Right.
So, they had an organ. They had a group called Black Kirby off of Jack Kirby, the illustrator. And so they said, yeah, this will be a great project for Black Kirby. And that's how we became a team and we worked.
Well, talk about how, you know, you take a book of I Am Alfonso Jones, and then you also have your Love to Langston. These books encounter censorship. And I think Love to Langston was censored in Florida. How do you as a writer respond?
I have a big smile on my face. Because I'm like, whoa, my work is really doing something if it's getting banned. You know, it's a double-edged sword.
Right.
Bert, you know, you kind of feel like, wow, this is great. And then on the other hand, you get kind of like peeved at the idea, like, how dare they? This is not. So it was like that for me. And it basically sells books. The notion of censorship is so silly, you know.
But let me ask you this, because we're not isolated in the community. You know, I know that you have a love for libraries. And I think that when I see things about being censored, you know, I'm thinking of libraries first. I'm thinking about the teacher in the classroom who all of a sudden, because of the school system, can't teach the work.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I become concerned about that. What should a writer do? Does the writer organize? I mean, you know, I know you said you were teaching in creative writing. And I was just wondering, when you talk to your students, do you say, okay, everyone here should be a member of these organizations that protect writers' rights?
Yeah, that's when you, like, you know, you become active, you go on social media, you start campaigning against that. I mean, I think Ta-Nehisi Coates even went to a church where they were discussing his book that was banned.
I think it was a town meeting or something, I think.
Yeah, a town hall meeting where he actually said, I'm going to show up. And those things. And then other writers come in. And there was an organization in Florida where Edwige Dondicott even read the Love to Langston book. And they gave out 400 copies. Mm. And Amanda Gorman even bought the books to give out to the kids and stuff like that. So there's so many overlaps that happen with individuals, organizations, and working together. And I think it's just kind of hard to really ban stuff, even though we're under such a fascist administration.
Well, let's talk about the other thing that may occur in your classroom. It has a lot to do with the issues that are of our times. And I would ask you, how do you, not just as a writer, but also as a teacher, how do you help writers who want to deal with issues of Gaza, Israel, anti-Semitism, genocide? How do you want them to navigate those issues?
Well, you know, things that happen in the world, I kind of like bring into the classroom by opening up discussions and seeing if the students are paying attention. A lot of times you find that college students are not yet at that stage, particularly undergraduates are not at that stage where they're paying attention to the news. They know what's happening politically and stuff. Some do, of course. So you have to kind of like bring these discussions in the class. So I started saying, you know, I got to have them write about that. We had a discussion first about what's happening in Palestine and the genocidal attacks in Gaza. And then I had them write haiku or tanka around Palestine. And man, they wrote some really powerful stuff. And then I asked them, well, can I put this on Facebook and share with the community? They said, sure, sure. So I don't want to hit them over the heads with my politics. You know, I want it to come kind of naturally to them. And I just want them to have some compassion and to think about the world and their environment and their place in it and how they're connected to these causes. Kind of like June Jordan's...
Poetry from the People in the Bay Area?
Well, when, yeah, that and also her notion about being Palestinian and being Black.
Oh, right, yeah. That would become part of Suhir Hamad, title of her book. You know, let me take you back to the classroom, Tony Medina, with something I think is very important, especially in terms of your being a teacher of creative writing. Talk about the difference between poetry, spoken word, performance poetry.
Yeah, early on, I didn't like being labeled a spoken word artist because I thought that it negated the fact that I come out of reading books, that tradition of writing on the page first and making sure that you can rock the page before you can just go to the stage and rock that. And I always thought that, you know, because of where we come from, like New York or Chicago or DC or Atlanta, whatever, that we, you know, and we're raised with music and all this stuff and storytelling in our household and jokes and puns, that we naturally, you know, perform and we can rock the stage, but that we take the discipline of writing and reading seriously, you know? So I was kind of against that. But then as I'm getting older, of course, I'm seeing that there is a space for performative aspects and not everything has to begin with the page, that there is a space for the stage. Mm-hmm. So I don't try to be as narrow-minded as I was mm-hmm. when I was younger.
Well, let me ask you. Say, for example, I'm a freshman on Howard's campus. I see your class offer and I'm excited, but I'm doing spoken word. You know, I'm hanging out and doing spoken word. And now what happens is that you're trying to get me to deal with the page. But I don't really, you know, I'm dealing with my ear, not my eye. And so what happens is that how do you, as a teacher, navigate that to say, okay, can you do both equally well? Or do you say, okay.
Yeah, you can. And Patricia Smith is an example of that. Because she, you know, came out of the whole slam thing in Chicago and stuff like that. And she's very much on the page, but she can also perform as well. But that's where the whole forms come in. Where you kind of like,
but look at that. If you take Patricia Smith, you can take, you know, when you were doing a slam, you had people, they were writing books first and then the slams and stuff came and they participated, you know, like Quincy Troop, for example, participated, I think of something like the heavyweight boxing, something of poetry. But what happens is that they were on the page first. If I'm of a generation now, I'm like, okay, I've just been listening to people. Okay, and that's how I got into poetry. You know, I don't have a book, you know. I don't even want a book.
Well, you know, I used to go to these readings where people would read or they'll do the open mic, and you could tell if they didn't read books, you know. Even in rap, you could tell when people, like, you listen to Tupac Shakur, you'd be like, oh, this guy reads books. You listen to KRS-One, oh, he's literate. Chuck D, you know. Then there are rappers where you'd be like, these people don't read. You know, they're very narrowly focused with their ideas. And even their rhymes are lame, you know. So you could tell when someone is learned, as they say. So you kind of challenge the spoken word mentality. You say, hey, there's nothing wrong with that. That's great. But let me show you something else.
Right.
And then once they start taking their poems seriously on the page and not just performing it, because it reads better, you know, when you focus on the gymnastics that you can do on the page. I remember Paul Beatty in the beginning in New York scene used to catch a lot of hell because he wasn't the best reader in the world. He was very shy.
But he was extremely funny.
Yeah. He would read with his head down into the mic. He was very shy, right? And people would say things about him. I said, but did you hear the words? The words do all the work. And it reminded me of how Miles Davis used to turn his back to get that. And then you learned that it wasn't about dissing the audience. It was about trying to get that sound off the walls. And so I said, try reading poems like that. You turn your back and you read it. then when you read it, if the words can do all the heavy lifting, it's a good poem.
Well, you know, it's interesting because if you look at poet's reading style, I'll take June, for example. There's a way that June turned her head to a mic, okay? And
that used to just read sideways.
Right. You know, and to me, that's a style and that's a sound. You know, like somebody say how you sound. That is tied into now.
Into jazz musician.
Okay, now you don't get that. So, tell me about your sound. What type of sound? You like a Roland Kirk, you know what I mean? You doing the whole, like, were you playing three instruments at one time? Talk about your sound.
I came up in the poetry scene in New York with people like Kevin Powell, Paul Beatty, Willie Perdomo, Asha Bandeli, Suhair Hamad. But, you know, we used to all hang out and we would go to the Village and get like used clothing in the vintage stores and stuff like that. We were really jazz heads. We were into bebop and all those cats. We wanted to be like them, dress like them, and also with the jackets, the ties, the little French hats and stuff. And so in our performance, and that got me, my first reading actually was at Baraka's Blues.
Over in Newark.
And I was so, you know, kind of nervous and shy. I didn't want to look at the audience. So I kind of treated the paper, the page, as a horn.
Are you caressing the page?
Like, you know, playing the trumpet. And so, you know, thinking about Miles, you know, that with that style and that stance and attitude.
So were you hunched over too, Tony?
Yes. And that's how I developed my performative aspects. But now, as you kind of experiment more with voice and this and that. But yeah, I wanted to emulate jazz artists, and a lot of my peers were doing that as well. And now, of course, people try to do hip hop and, you know, with their hand gestures and stuff like that.
Talk about that. We're moving towards the end of our program in terms of, you know, we talk about the Black Arts Movement, you know, we talk about jazz, but hip hop has a real strong international presence on our culture. And talk about that and maybe link that back into sports, because, you know, we're talking about baseball, but we know if you're going to talk about hip hop, you got to talk about Iverson. You know what I mean? You have these connections between how things are becoming global, but at the same time, you know, you can see this definite influence in terms of African-American influence.
Well, you know, our culture has always been multi-layered, interconnected. You know this coming from the Bronx, you know. We use a lot of Yiddish words.
Right. Yeah, somebody told me my mother sounded Jewish. I remember that.
We speak Spanglish, Yiddish, Italian phrases. We have certain ways that we speak. People used to say, damn, I didn't know you spoke like that. We sound different, you know? And so everything influences us. Mm-hmm. We are the definition of multiculturalism. I mean, you have Panamanian roots. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's like so vibrant and so electric, being able to come from a big city where there's so many different people from all over. We're not into all that racism, stupidity stuff. But we're influenced by all the art forms.
Well, let's end on this note, okay? Where do you see talking about Afrofuturism, that we see a lot of people come into the class, and they're, you know, they've been reading Octavia Butler, they're Sam Delaney, you know, and they're saying, Tony, you're just from this planet.
Well, Afrofuturism is great. It's just that I don't like when we create these little boxes, you know, in a fad. Something becomes a fad. Spoken word thing, that was that at that time, even though spoken word existed from the beginning. You know, we all come from the oral traditions. But I just see it's always going to get better. The art is going to get better. I just wish that more artists, particularly in hip hop, would engage the times and speak to these times, these precarious times that we're living in. And they were
struggling. Well, I want to thank you for speaking to me today, Tony Medina, because this has been important in terms of our conversation. And I hope this will continue. My guest today has been Tony Medina. He's a poet and editor of more than 20 books for adults and young readers. And he's a professor at Howard University, where he teaches creative writing. The show is On the Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM. Thank you.
Hello, WPFW listeners. Summertime is here. Words, Beats, and Life has the event for your family and friends this season. The second annual DMV Made Festival is happening Saturday, July 26th on the National Mall, a one-day celebration of the D.C., Maryland, Virginia region, promoting the intersections of arts and culture, plus health and wellness. With live music by Go-Go Legends, EU featuring Sugar Bear, vocalist Navasha Deya, jazz fusion trio The Mastetics, Black Folks Don't Swim, Kamau, and much more. Plus Family Fun Zone, Poetry and Storytelling Pavilion, Interactive Dance Stage, Live Art Installations, Hands-On Workshops, and Health and Wellness Pavilion. July 26th on the National Mall. Full details at wblinc.org/DMVMade. See you there. Brought to you by Words, Beats, and Life with support from WPFW.
Sego, this is John Kane, and I want to invite you to join me right here on WPFW on Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native. I will deliver guests and commentary each week on the real-life issues facing Native people. No romanticizing and no Hollywood stereotypes here. We'll talk real history and culture and life as it is and as it should be. Our shows are available as podcasts on your favorite podcast platforms and as videos on our Let's Talk Native TV YouTube channel. Find links and more at our website, www.letstalknative.com. And I'll see you here Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native with John Kane.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
The Birchmere presents Omar, July 17th. Hubert Laws, July 20th. Hiroshima, July 24th. And Sheila E., July 30th. Details at TheBirchmere.com.
No social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world one broadcast at a time.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now and interview